You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Christina Tokoingua, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Tuesday Wire for this week, the 14th of June. My name is Christina and I'm your host for the Tuesday Wire. Producing for the show today was supposed to be Jack, but he is currently away. It is the break at the moment, so he's probably having a good time away from the studio, leaving me all by myself. That's totally okay. We've got a great show coming up for you today. Ifaya Kene, Marcus Jones is joining us for Dear Science live in the studio, discussing the coolest, latest sciencey news bits. I'm speaking to political scientist Dr. Lara Greaves about Labour's cabinet reshuffle yesterday. Anika has her weekly catch-up with the National Party's Dr. Shane Retty. This week they're speaking about gangs. I'm also speaking to Dr. Jared Gilbert, a sociologist from the University of Canterbury, about New Zealand's war on gangs. I'm talking to activist Chenille Lal about the recent controversy surrounding Bethlehem College in Tauranga over their treatment of LGBTQ students. And finally, Jack is speaking to Byron Clark about the far-right's adoption of conservationist ideology in a twist that no one really saw coming. So stay tuned. Hea hao whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces or any of your thoughts at all. What's on your mind? Tuku patui mai. You can text us on 5395 or waia mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Also, after the show, kaua e wareware e ahena koutou te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero anō. E pakehere rukiruki mārongi i te pai tukutuku e Erenangi Pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM i rakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. As usual, let's dive in.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Marcus. How are you going?
Good. How are you?
Good, thank you. It is the end of the semester, so as an academic, I can't imagine this has been a fun kind of period for you.
Oh, I don't know. It's been okay.
Yeah, are you ready to see the back of some of your students?
No, I love my students, all of them.
In case any of you guys are listening, Marcus Jones loves you guys. So. Yeah, but we've got some really cool stuff coming up on Dear Science today. The first thing is that this could be the end of particle physics. And I don't know if you guys know much about particle physics. I'm no expert. I've never claimed to be. But what is so interesting about this recently, I guess?
Well, there's headlines that saying the LHC, the sort of the Large Hadron Collider, which is the big particle collider that's in Switzerland, it hasn't really found very much in the last 10 years. Since the big find of the Higgs boson in 2012, there hasn't really been a big headline-grabbing find that sort of rewrites physics and particle physics and dramatically increases our understanding of the universe. And so there's all these clickbait headlines saying this is the end of particle physics and this is the end of the LHC. And to be honest, it's probably very unlikely that this is the case. But it is true, though, that there has been basically a 10-year hangover, I guess, since the discovery of the Higgs boson. And it hasn't found an awful lot else. I mean, there's lots of findings, obviously, but nothing that's grabbed the same sort of publicity and made the same sort of change to particle physics. So people are starting to wonder, especially at this point when they're about to turn the LHC back on again and start looking at data. They're starting to wonder, you know, is it really worth it? Are they likely to find anything? So, but a lot of physicists say it's really too early to despair. The LHC has just had 3 years worth of upgrades, and it's just about to power up for the third of five planned runs. So this is only the third of five, and some new particles could emerge in the literally billions and trillions of proton-proton collisions it will produce every second. In fact, the LHC is slated to run for another 16 years, and with further upgrades, should collect about 16 times as much data as it already has. And all these data could reveal subtle signs of novel particles, new phenomena, things like that. On the other side, some researchers still say that the writing is on the wall for collider physics. If they don't find anything, some people are saying the field is dead. Physicists in the University of Chicago and in London are maybe saying that it's going to be like the next few years are going to be like pulling teeth in terms of finding new data in the LHC. Now, this all sort of centers around the big model that we use to understand particle physics and really understand the universe, which is called the Standard Model. And since the 1970s, this has been the model that really helps us understand all the data that's coming out of the LHC. And the Standard Model describes everything scientists have seen at particle colliders so far. We had to add in the Higgs boson, but now that's all done, and I think it's there's nothing that's really been shown to contradict the Standard Model. Yet, but the LHC was supposed to break this sort of this impasse, because the Standard Model describes everything, but it leaves out one major force, and this is the force that holds us on planet Earth, which is gravity, and it doesn't include any understanding about gravity. It understands all the other forces are contained in the Standard Model, but not gravity. And obviously, gravity exists. So, the LHC was supposed to break this sort of impasse, and in its ring, protons that are circulating in opposite directions crash at energies nearly seven times as high as in any previous collider, which enables the LHC to produce particles that are really much bigger than can be measured elsewhere. And so people were hoping that this would, you know, give us some understanding of any new physics, or at least start to help us understand how gravity fits on with the Standard Model. But although there have been some interesting finds over the last decade, there's nothing there that really is. They're still waiting for this eureka moment to show some new physics, something completely new out of the right. Standard Model.
But that must be really frustrating, though, if you just hang around for what could be years trying to find something and just
absolutely
nothing happening. It's annoying. Switching tracks here, our second topic was about the recent Tonga volcano eruption. So researchers have found why exactly it might have been so explosive. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and this is sort of incredible. The scale of this thing is actually incredible. So the researchers are starting sort of to piece together why the eruption of this underwater volcano in Tonga was so explosive. What happened in the aftermath, and you know, sort of how we can explain the whole thing. So the Hunga Haapai volcano erupted on the 15th of January this year. Most of you will have seen this in the news. It produced the largest atmospheric explosion in recorded history.
Wow.
Biggest ever. Mm. It sent shockwaves around the world and a plume of ash into the upper atmosphere. And since then, people have been trying to figure out what happened. Shane Cronin, who's a volcanologist at the University of Auckland, where we're sitting, he led a group that sailed over the volcano's caldera, the big central
hole.
Depression, the hole. and so they sailed over and used sonar to map its structure, and they found a 4-kilometer-wide caldera had dropped in depth from less than 200 meters below the sea to more than 850 meters below the sea. So it produced this enormous new, basically, hole in the ground, and he estimates that some 6.5 cubic kilometers of rock were thrown out. That's roughly equivalent to a sphere as wide as the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. So imagine a sphere that diameter. That's the amount of rock that was spat out of this volcano. And the reasons for this explosion are probably the interaction between large amounts of magma and water. As the eruption began, you got sort of 20 degree water and you got about 1100 degree magma coming in direct contact. And such a large temperature difference means that as the water was forced into contact with the magma by the eruption, it sort of exploded. And each interaction pushed the water deeper into the edges of the magma, which further drove the explosions in sort of a chain reaction.
Have you kind of seen this in other cases, other explosions that have happened in the past, maybe?
I don't know. I'm not a volcanologist, but I think it's sort of a serendipitous, if you can call it like that, sort of coming together of
a lot of things happening at once. Big boom.
So it was shallow enough so the water pressure didn't suppress the blast, but it was deep enough that there was still huge amounts of water to power the explosion.
Right.
So it was a sort of I guess in the sweet spot in terms of the size of explosion it could generate. Hmm. There's another team from NIWA who have been looking at the volcano, and they sampled ash from the seafloor around the volcano. And that showed that the eruption was probably followed by pyroclastic flows. This is hot streams of ash and lava that rained down over the submerged sides of the volcano. And these would have spread thousands of square kilometers away from the eruption. They ripped up seafloor cables, including those providing Tonga access to the internet, which still haven't been fully restored. There's the impacts on ocean oxygen levels. And though not everything was decimated, satellite data have shown there's a big bloom of phytoplankton in the ocean following the eruption, and they fed on the nutrients released by the blast. And there's some really incredible sort of data about a few other events that happened after the eruption. So there was a tsunami that was detected as far away as the French Mediterranean coast. So if you know where Tonga is in the Pacific,
oh my God!
So imagine you've got the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans, and they could still see a few centimeters rise in sea level all the way over in France.
That's scary.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
There was a water vapor plume that reached a height of about 53 kilometers, well into the stratosphere, and it's now encircled the globe, and it's increased the water vapor content of the stratosphere by about 10%. It will probably remain in the atmosphere for at least a year. So these are noticeable major effects on our atmosphere.
Yeah, the scale of just these natural disasters is quite shocking and really scary. So, you know, you really hope that you don't see life-changing events happening in your lifetime.
Absolutely,
Let's hope for no asteroids in the near next 100 years or so, at least. Thank you so much for joining us, Marcus. That was Dear Science, an excellent episode as usual.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hey, aha, o whakaaro. We'd love to hear your thoughts on any of today's pieces. So if you feel like you learned something on Dear Science or anything else, you can text us on 5395. Our cabinet restructures halfway through a term. Sorry about that. That was the start of the next piece. So basically, yesterday, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced the departure of Chris Farfoy and Trevor Mallard from politics, and with it, a number of changes to cabinet. This morning, I spoke to political scientist Dr. Lara Greaves about these changes. She's from the University of Auckland and a regular B contributor.
I think this is too unexpected. I think that Ardern and Cabinet generally had been under a bit of pressure from the opposition given recent poll numbers and across certain specific portfolios as well. I think that media and commentators generally pointed to there being some underperforming ministers. So I don't think this is too unexpected. And I think actually, if anything, this is more of a positive thing because it's showing that Ardern is willing to evolve her cabinet and her government over time and to make those changes. Because one of the criticisms when Helen Clark left and Labour lost previously was that there was this, you know, a lot of people that were more at the top end or senior and a bit of a vacuum was left by her departure. So I see this as a really good kind of shuffle or like putting incremental steps in place to start structuring some more talented, more early career people into those executive portfolios.
The main story that's been on the headlines is that Trevor Mallard is leaving. He is heading overseas to take up a diplomatic role. Ardern has denied his departure was due to recent pressure from the opposition over his handling of the parliament protests. But the timing is quite convenient. It comes just days after he came under fire for refusing to acknowledge the trespass notices he issued. What do you make of this?
I think that Trevor Mallard's term as Speaker has been really controversial, and there's a lot more that's happened in it as well, and Ardern has acknowledged that, but he's faced a lot of challenges that normally Speakers don't face. I think that we never expected him to be one of those more subtle, quiet Speakers, and he has done a lot of things around, like, parental leave and making the House more receptive to babies and children and that sort of thing. So he has done some stuff as Speaker, showed some leadership there. But there have been a lot of controversial points in his term as Speaker. We also recently saw a poll from TVNZ that showed that only around 20% of people approved of him as Speaker. And so it then became a bit of a distraction for the government. And he's been a distraction for quite some time, because I remember talking about this about a year and a half ago as well, that he had... The controversy over him naming and the court case around him saying that there was a rapist in Parliament, that was also a huge controversy that a lot of people wanted him to go over. So I think that it's just the writing's been on the wall for this for quite some time. And I think that, again, it's a good point to bring in Adrian Rudasse as Speaker and to really show him in the role as well. So I think that it's a very advantageous time in the electoral cycle to have Adrian Rudasse in that role as well, because we know that Te Tai Hauāuru, Adrian's seat, is going to be quite closely run between him and Debbie Nadewa-Packer next election. So I think that that's a really important point there. But generally, I think a lot of people have been thinking for quite some time that Trevor Mallard would be moved on. And I think that going away to a diplomatic post has always been something that, if that next thing that you move your long-serving MPs, your long-serving ministers onto.
The opposition has gone after him quite hard and kind of almost accusing him of bias at some points. But the role of the Speaker is supposed to be diplomatic at its core, regardless of political affiliation. Would the National Party or the opposition parties be attempting to bring in their own people? Would they have the numbers for that?
Generally, what's going to happen here is that... Labour's nominee, Adrian Rudasse, will take over as Speaker. There's no real way or precedent for them to now bring in a National Party Speaker per se. And I think that Adrian will do an excellent job in the role. He's done great as Deputy Speaker, and whenever I've seen him performing in the House, he's been very more dignified, quiet, but authoritative, and I think he will do excellently in that role, because he also has less of that political baggage that Trevor Mallard had as well. So I think that generally now it's just a case of seeing how Adrian Rudasse goes as Speaker. The Speaker's role is incredibly tough. I think Mallard likened it at one point to like refereeing a sports game when your kid's playing. So it's a bit tricky to be able to put aside those personal biases and actually do the role. So I think it's a really tough role to make sure that you do kind of maintain that neutrality, but still... You are ultimately, someone like Trevor Mallard has been part of the Labour Party for more than 35 years, so it's incredibly tough to seem like you're being neutral. And I think there have been certain times in Parliament that you could definitely point to where he wasn't as neutral as he could have been.
Switching tracks here, Porter Williams has also been stripped of the police portfolio, with Chris Hipkins set to take up the role. With the media kind of reporting a spike in gang violence and ram raids in the past few weeks, and Luxon calling for Williams to go, was this change expected?
I think we all kind of expected Porter Williams to be reshuffled, and the moment that this cabinet reshuffle was announced, that was the one that a lot of people were pointing to. I think that the real tricky thing about being a minister is it's also your job to get out there and sell the policy. And policy around crime and the police is incredibly complex. So there's so many factors at play around poverty and inequality and intergenerational trauma and all sorts of different factors going on there. And also things like police operations, which are incredibly tricky. So there's so many factors going on. You have to figure out some way to sell any policy in that space to the public, and also really be on the defence from parties like National and ACT, who people generally associate with being tough on law and order. So it's an incredibly tricky position to be in, and Porter Williams, by pretty much all accounts, has not really succeeded in that role. And so it's really important now, I think, to have someone like Chris Hipkins in the role that can stand up to Luxon and stand up to David Seymour and ACT and be able to really articulate what Labor's vision for this area is. And that's going to be really important going forward, to see what does that more centre-left police minister, like, what does that role look like now and with all of the different competing pressures that happening in 2022.
Chris Hipkins does have a lot of political experience, but he also has several other major portfolios at the moment. Ahead of the election, wouldn't it make more sense to kind of prioritise this portfolio, which is expected to be quite a hotly contested topic?
I think that Chris Hipkins will be really good at getting out there and like standing up for Labor and their policy agenda and really articulating it. And I think that that's where it's quite important to have someone that can really have the good quips and the good comebacks and really stand up and sell Labor policy that they're going to put in place. I think that he is spread across a lot of areas. They've kind of tried to back him up by, you know, making the various associate ministers in place. And I think he is someone who works really hard and covers a lot of portfolios. I mean, we have seen with Chris Farfoy that he seems to be burnt out. So we just kind of really, I think as a society, hope that that doesn't keep happening to various ministers. Because, yeah, Chris Hipkins has been the sort of, I think Toby Manhire called him like Fix-It-Kins, because people always make jokes about his last name. But that's what he has been. He has been the Minister Fix-It. And I think that, you know, out of all of the people that they have there, he is someone who could make a really good run at police. But there is that risk of him being spread a bit thin, and there is that risk of, as well, burnout.
That was political scientist Dr. Lara Greaves speaking to me about Labour's cabinet reshuffle. We'll be right back with some more news content after this.
95BFM presents Winter Best, a free and family-friendly music festival here to warm your wintry soul with a massive 30 acts over 5 stages.
Featuring Leisure, The Betts, Weird Together, Tammy Nielsen, Tiny Ruins Solo, Finn Andrews, Carnivorous Plant Society, Anika Moore, Julian Dine, Anna Coddington, Kidu Kahlo, Luana, and more.
Winter Best, Saturday, June 18th at Corbin Estates Arts Centre. Tickets are free but extremely limited. Get yours now at winterbest.nz.
This year, you'll be making a romantic comedy featuring a sandwich with a montage.
This is going to take a whole lot of bananas.
The greatest guerrilla film competition in Aotearoa is back for 2022. The Vista Foundation 48 Hours. Registrations are open for its 20th year, so get your gang together and get ready for some serious monkeying around. Shoot weekend is August 12th to the 14th. Go to 48hours.co.nz.
Science. Yep, it's all around us. A rock. That's science. Sandals. That's science too. My wife calling me to tell me to pick up some milk. You'd never know it, but that's science too. But where and what day do we go to find out about more science?
Dear Science, join the Tuesday Wire team as they speak to a rotating roster of boffins and brainiacs chatting about discoveries, controversies, and general scientific wonder. Dear Science, every Tuesday Wire on 95BFM. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
I don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire with Christina. Bethlehem College, a Christian school in Tauranga, has recently come under fire for asking parents to sign a statement of belief saying marriage is between a man and a woman. LGBTQ plus advocates have condemned this practice, calling it discriminatory and homophobic. However, several ex-students of the college have since commented on a post with allegations of homophobia and abuse at the school. Chenille Lal, co-founder of In Conversion Therapy, launched a petition for the Education Review Office to investigate the school. So far, 5,700 people have signed this. Chenille is on the line now. Kia ora, Chenille. Thank you so much for joining me.
Kia ora.
So, with this post, when you first posted about Bethlehem's statement of belief, did you expect so many people to comment with allegations of discrimination at the school?
Well, at first I thought that this was a classic example of extremist Christians being extremists, right? I thought that this anti-same-sex marriage view was just something that they practiced as a part of their religion. And I didn't want to post about it, but there was something in me that said you have to call it out. And when I did call it out, I did not realize the gravity of the abuse that was going on in this school. Because since I made that post, people have come forward with allegations of conversion therapy from counselors, anti-queer verbal abuse from teachers. Girls have said that the school held an assembly in which they victim-blamed victims of rape and sexual assault. Other students say that the students at school have been wearing blackface and teachers have been using the N-word. And it has a really toxic attitude towards mental well-being as well. A student told me that they were asked to leave the school because the school thought that their mental health problems was making the school look bad or jeopardizing their reputation. And another said that when they expressed that they were suffering from mental health problems, they were told it was a result of their sin. So, you know, the Minister of Education and the Education Review Office in the past have overlooked all these things, and that is why I'm calling for an independent review of the school.
The school responded to these allegations and they said, Christian beliefs support and enhance the health and well-being of our students. That was a direct quote. Is it kind of possible to reconcile Christian beliefs with supporting LGBTQ plus students?
Well, I think the reason why I'm very clear that this is extremism is because I know lots of Christians who do not believe in condemning queer people to hell.
Mm.
I think essentially what Bethlehem College is admitting or implying is that their Christian beliefs are synonymous to homophobia and transphobia and racism and sexism, but that doesn't have to be the reality. There are lots of Christians and many who have condemned Bethlehem for their poor behavior. So, absolutely, Christians and queer people can exist. In fact, there are lots of Christians who are queer themselves.
The Conversion Practices Prohibition Legislation Bill passed its third reading back in February. Did you expect this kind of behaviour to still persist with this bill passing its third reading?
Yep, absolutely. The problem with the conversion therapy ban in Aotearoa is that it's not practical. It's a symbolic bill that kind of just sends a message that conversion therapy is wrong, but it doesn't have anything in the bill that allows any investigation. For example, Bethlehem College, no one can actually go into the school under that legislation and look at if conversion therapy is actually happening. The law requires young people who are experiencing conversion therapy to come ahead and report to the police. Now, these young people at Bethlehem College, they are afraid.
Mm.
And they will not be going to the police because they know at the end of the day they have to go back to this college.
What powers would an Education Review Office investigation grant to people looking into these practices?
Well, I mean, the problem with the Education Review Office is that they alert the school that they're coming, and then in response, the school trains all of their students to behave in a certain way, and then they tell teachers to enforce those behaviours. So when someone's sitting in your class trying to look at what's happening in the class, all students behave because they've been told to. The Education Review Office can talk to individual students, they can talk to individual teachers, and they should do that. They should also talk to students who have they should also talk to former students, because those are the students who are not afraid to speak about their experiences.
That was Chenille Lal, the co-founder of End Conversion Therapy New Zealand, speaking to me about accusations of discriminatory behaviour at Bethlehem College in Tauranga.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
This week, Anika discussed gangs with Dr. Shane Ritti from the National Party for their regular segment. Here they are now.
So today I wanted to talk about the rising spike in gang violence that we're seeing, and I was wondering if we could please start off by maybe outlining what you and the National Party believe to be some of the root causes.
Sure. So we can all see the significant increase in gang tension over a period of time now. And in fact, the previous minister reported in the House last week that there had been 23 drive-by shootings or significant events over the past few weeks, particularly in Auckland. And I think if we look at any crime and go to root cause, we would start with issues of inequity, we would start with issues of poverty, we'd start with issues of education, there may well be issues of housing in that as well. Some of the social determinants that place people in situations where they might commit crimes and come to the attention of the judiciary and come to the attention of corrections, for example, are all underlying root causes, first of all. So we have those social determinants that place people in that situation. Secondly, we have the 501s who have returned from Australia, who are returning for a purpose because they have created a significant issue in Australia. And they bring with them a track record and pattern of behaviour. that clearly for many can be a challenge to rehabilitate in New Zealand. So it's a combination of those things. I know a large number of people are saying it's significantly driven by the 501s, and that may well be the case, but we had our own homegrown gang tensions as well, which are predicated on many of those social factors.
Just yesterday in the cabinet reshuffle, Chris Hipkins has now taken on the role of Minister of Police. Do you have more hope for Chris Hipkins in that role?
Look, that decision to remove the previous police minister and insert a new one is a call for the Prime Minister to make. Clearly, things needed to change, and I think the conclusion that they drew that of recent times the focus has not been where it needed to be and want, where they wanted it to be is a signal that they were looking for a change. So I've worked with Chris in health, and I've had a good working relationship with him. He isn't necessarily my direct portfolio opposite, but my working experience with Chris has been good, and so hopefully he can sink his teeth into this role and quickly, because you know, day by day to be getting serious criminal events is undermining the safety that New Zealanders have in their own personal property and in their own persons, if you like, their own personal safety.
Now, Christopher Luxon has expressed a desire to increase police powers, starting off with the banning of gang patches and insignia in public. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern dismissed this idea as a reactionary response, which, when tried in other countries, has effected no real change. How would you respond to that?
I'd say several things. Chris Luxon and the National Party are bringing through ideas, bringing through concepts that are being trialled, have been tried and have had some success, particularly in Australia. We reached out for examples of what is being used. I think secondly, let's also remember this also already occurs in government buildings like hospitals and courts. So to suggest that it wouldn't work in New Zealand is, you know, how does that work? It's already a precedent and seems to be functional in those places. So I think it's a hollow response to being late to the game, actually.
Right, and another power that Luxon suggested giving police is the power to issue dispersal notices to anyone they reasonably suspect of being a gang member or gang prospect, as well as issue consorting prohibition notices to stop gang offenders associating with one another. Are there concerns that this power could be misused and or abused by the police, and how could you ensure these notices are being issued fairly?
So all powers that are bestowed by government, be it on police or other authorities, it needs to have checks and balances. And this would be no different. There would need to be well thought out policies with checks and balances to make sure the appropriate decision making and appropriate force is brought to a policy of this kind. And I've heard some people raise questions about where does this sit with respect to human rights. Let's remember that the Bill of Rights allows exemptions when one right overrides another. So your right to be safe from personal harm, can override a right for you to wear insignia or to intimidate or to gather in an illegal sort of fashion. So I think that can be addressed when one understands the hierarchy of the Bill of Rights that does give exemptions for some rights to override others.
Right. Now, I have seen concerns raised that the National Party's policies to crack down on gangs would discriminate against members' families, and that these policies had had a disproportionate negative effect on Māori and Pacifica communities in the past. Are you aware of this? Do you appreciate these concerns?
I think that can be, we certainly understand that Māori very tragically overrepresented in many of these statistics we're trying to turn around, but often that can be an explanation that's too easy to reach for when people are hearing what they don't want to hear. And what this government doesn't want to hear is the increasing crime, the increasing statistics, and I think to parade that as an explanation doesn't really cut it. We need to have firm policies, we need to have them now, and let's not just run out the same poor explanation with no thinking behind it. Bring persuasive reasoning to the table, and we've laid four or five things on the table we think would make a difference.
Now, I've also seen policies like these being likened to militarising the police force against gangs. which in the past has seemed to only deepen the systemic racism and racial profiling felt by the Māori and Pacifica community. Would you be able to address these concerns?
So this is why it would be really important for policies of this type that we bring on board and seek guidance and counsel from those who actually represent the communities most likely to be affected, which would be Māori and Pacifica. And we know the cultural competency officers and the Māori advisory officers and the police do an incredible job and are very, very useful in helping us bridge that gap between judiciary and those affected iwi and Māori communities, and that we'd be looking to draw on their deep expertise and their guidance as to how we could implement policies of this sort for the reasons that you're mentioning.
Right, and the other thing that I've seen is that these policies are focusing on gangs more than they're focusing on the actual criminal activity, and the activity itself needs to be the centre of the crackdown as opposed to gangs in general. How would you respond to that?
The centre of the policy needs to be looking back at the root cause and wrapping that around whatever the policy intent is. However, the reality is that when we have a crisis like we have here now, there needs to be urgent protection of property, urgent protection of people's persons, and then behind that needs to be the longer and deeper look into the determinants of crime and doing a better job with that.
That was News and Editorial Director Anika speaking to the National Party's Dr. Shane Retty for their weekly catch-up. You're on The Wire with Christina. Send me a text on 53955 or give me a call on 309 3879 if you feel like a chat.
The glitz, the glamour. All the stars are coming out for Hollywood Nights. Three nights of free entertainment live at the Hollywood Avondale.
Thursday, June 23rd features Liao, Phoebe Rings, Carnivorous Plant Society, DJ Tuafali Tanuai.
Hollywood Nights at the Hollywood Avondale, June 17th, 23rd and 24th. Tickets are free, but booking is essential. Go to hollywoodavondale.nz.
Punk it up at the power station. Your last chance to see No Tag ever. Up the punks.
All right. Spot time, I reckon.
Got any utensils? We'll sacrifice some, eh? We're going to need a vessel too. I'll scale the last of the spark from Duet.
Wait.
Yeah, spot's on.
Whoa, nah, I mean the beer spot, you know? Amazing, independent NZ beer.
Ah, oh, the legal buzz. Gotcha.
The 95BFM Drive Show, a fully legal, three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday, only on 95BFM. Thanks to the Beer Spot, your tabby place.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
Gangs, gang violence, drugs and organised crime. We're seeing a lot of this in the headlines recently, and a lot of fear surrounding gangs in Aotearoa is perhaps one reason why politicians are keen to flex their political muscle, introducing increasingly punitive laws. However, recent research has shown these laws haven't worked in the past whenever there was a media frenzy about gang violence. I spoke to Dr. Jared Gilbert, a sociologist from the University of Canterbury, about this.
Well, it started in 1996 in a situation remarkably similar to what we've got now, actually, and that was that gangs were at war. Two protagonists in Christchurch, and then when that died away, another one sparked up in Invercargill. And this was before the 1996 election, and it fired the politicians up, and they created numerous laws that they put in place to target the gangs. And what I did is looked at how often those laws have been used and how they've been used. And what we can see is that the vast majority of them were unworkable. And those that were used against non-gang members, i.e. the public generally, far, far more often than gang members. So they were hopeless. And I think we can conclude from that policy agenda was more about garnering votes ahead of election than it was a serious attempt to counter the gang issues. And I would bet anything you like that this will occur again, and undoubtedly with the same outcomes.
Well, it does sound very familiar, because in the recent 2022 budget, the government announced an extra $600 million to tackle gangs. This included funding for police to directly target them. Was this out of a genuine concern for public safety, or was it kind of an attempt to prove they're not soft on crime?
Look, the public have every right to be concerned when people are brazenly firing shots into houses and down public streets. That is a concern. But none of the laws that were brought in last time solved those issues. And the reason for that, at least in part, is these are, despite what seems instinctive, these are very complex issues. And tackling them is going to require some real thinking and some real research, two things that politicians don't do well. In fact, the introduction to the swathe of laws that came around and that were first proposed in 1996, the introductory note to the bill said there was no independent research to verify any of this. Well, there still isn't. And so politicians are basically floundering around in the dark with a candlelight when they need to turn on some big torches to really see what the situation is. Otherwise, what we're doing is it's a sop to the public. It's a way of saying, hey, we're doing something, don't worry about it, but not actually tackling the problem. The slight problem there is that ever since 1972, when Norman Kirk, in opposition, promised to take the bikes off the bikies again before an election, and never did it. Ever since, there's been a lot of talk on the hustings. It garners a lot of votes. Thus, politicians say it is successful, but thus far has not been successful in countering the issues of gangs.
Some people have proposed introducing anti-consorting and anti-bikey laws here, but critics have said that these laws only work to drive gangs further underground. Do you think politicians would seriously consider introducing those kinds of laws here?
Well, they have been introduced in Australia, right? So, mind you, Australia is a pretty different country, but in so many ways. But, yeah, look, they could be introduced here, I think. They have been tried to a small degree in Whanganui back in, I think, maybe around 2009, something like that, I can't actually recall. And there were some real rights-based issues there. They ended up falling over. But at the time, actually, some in the police came out in the organised crime squad said, hang on a second, why are we taking patches off our crooks? Because if all criminals self-identified, it makes our life much easier. The head of the gang unit at the time actually said, well, you know, patches allow the public at least to make some decisions about how they'll behave, and that might be avoid them. For example, when you remove those identifiers, you don't remove the problems, you just remove the identifiers. So in America, for example, if you think of the Blood and Crip type gangs, they don't wear back patches, but they sure as heck associated with violence. So they just drive the gangs underground and make them a little difficult to spot. It's very unlikely to solve the problems of the gangs.
Recently, National MP Simeon Brown tried to introduce a bill that would ban government funds going to gangs. This was in response to Jacinda Ardern approving millions of dollars going towards a mongrel mob-led rehabilitation program. The bill was described by other MPs as just dog whistling to a very narrow, often racist voter base. So why are gangs such an easy target when it comes to anti-crime rhetoric?
Yeah, that was a trust that was running a drug and alcohol rehabilitation program. And so it wasn't really giving money to the mongrel mob per se, but you know, that those types of things are a bit lost in the rhetoric. But I tell you, it does raise a broader issue here, actually. And that is, when we talk about gang, we're ostensibly talking about men in patches who are part of these fraternities. But in reality, we're actually talking about men with wives and with kids and with uncles and with aunties. And we also know that disproportionately these groups exist in Māori communities. So when we've got an acute focus, quite rightly in my view, on trying to extricate Māori from these types of issues, ill-defined laws that target these communities could create some real problems for Māori. And so we need to make sure that laws that are poorly drafted don't actually create more harm than good. You know, there's a balance here, right? The gangs are causing issues. No one's saying that they don't need to be addressed, but firebrand politics from the hustings is unlikely to be a great way forward.
Finally, many media outlets are reporting an increased number of gang-related violent incidents, including involving firearms. This mirrors a similar media frenzy about organised crime back in the 90s, like you laid out in your research. What impact does the media have on the general public's perception of gangs?
Look, it's really significant. For example, you know, you would think that gangs are the most significant problem facing New Zealand, given the amount of column inches that are given to them. But if you look, even just look at family violence, you know, one every 5 weeks, a toddler in New Zealand is killed within the home. That doesn't get half the attention that it needs to, because it's not just the horrific circumstances which end these little kids' lives, but for each one that's killed, you know, on average, one every 5 weeks, for each one of those, there are scores that grow up beaten and scarred physically and emotionally. And those kids don't go on to become journalists or academics or doctors or lawyers. They end up populating our prisons. That is a far bigger issue, far bigger issue. With the, in fact, they populate the gangs. So, you know, and so we talk and we talk and we talk and we talk about gangs. Now, they are an issue, but by goodness, it's not proportionate to other concerns around law and order, not by a long shot.
That was sociologist Dr. Jared Gilbert speaking to me about New Zealand's war on gangs.
They are nicking our shit. They totally are.
The Wire.
Content warning, this next piece discusses xenophobia, racism and far-right violence. In mid-May, the world was shocked when an armed man entered a supermarket in Buffalo, New York and opened fire on ordinary shoppers. It soon became clear that the shooting was a white supremacist terrorist attack. The shooter cited talking points from a new sector of the far right to justify his actions. This ideology is called ecofascism. Jack talked to author and activist Byron Clark, an expert on the far right and disinformation, to find out what ecofascism is and why we should be concerned about it.
What is ecofascism?
So ecofascism is a variant of fascism that takes into account ecology and the environment. So it may acknowledge climate change, or I think there are, if you look at the far right in New Zealand today, I wouldn't say ecofascism is a particularly big tendency in there, because there's also a lot of climate change denial, but I think even with that, some of these ecofascist ideas can infiltrate the section of the far right that is still under climate change denial, because they can still use environmentalism or ecology to justify things like restricting immigration. That's a big one. It's this idea that if we allow people to immigrate here, that's going to have a detrimental effect on the environment because of the greater use of resources and so forth. I think you can trace some of these ideas back to the original, like, 20th century fascism, like the whole ideas around like blood and soil and people being tied to the land and other people being foreigners and not part of that ecology the way that people that, you know, the native white people in Europe were, for example.
And do you think that these people are actually environmentalists, or is this really just a scheme to continue pushing xenophobic and racist narratives?
It's hard to say. I think for some of them, there would be some genuine environmental concerns there. I think, you know, some of these ideas have had an influence in the more mainstream environmental movement, and I think some people have come out of that and then developed sort of more eco-fascist ideas when they start to believe that, you know, the root problem with that environmental degradation is too many people. Then they can develop these xenophobic ideas and also eugenicist ideas about restricting population and things like that. So I think for some of them it's a genuine environmentalism, and I think for others it's a way to make their fascist ideas more palatable by claiming that they're doing it not because of any kind of racial supremacy, but because of a, you know, genuinely environmental concern. So I think there's a mix of true believers and opportunists in there.
After the Buffalo shooting last month or a couple of months ago, it was very clear that the shooter was an eco-fascist, and he was obviously very young. And a lot of these ideas have been picked up online through, like far-right sectors of the internet, and even quite a lot of, like, internet memes. Do you think that big tech companies should be doing more to restrict this kind of content?
I think there's more that big tech companies could be doing. I think since the Christchurch call, more has been done. One thing I've been looking at recently with the book I'm writing is looking at the ways that
algorithms used by YouTube and Facebook have played a big role in influencing people towards disinformation and, in some cases, actual far-right content and ideas. Facebook did a number of their own internal studies around 2016 where they found that they could make a new account and based on giving this person a few personality attributes like being a conservative and a Christian and so forth, that it wouldn't take long before the algorithm would start suggesting this person joined like QAnon conspiracy groups and groups that actually violated Facebook's own terms and conditions but were still being promoted by the algorithm because this account they created had a similar personality type to others in these groups. And I think that sort of thing's been tightened up a little bit. Similar thing with YouTube, where the algorithm, in an effort to just keep your eyes on the screen for as long as possible, would suggest videos that were increasingly extreme. So you might start out watching a more mainstream conservative piece of content, like something from Fox News, and then you'd get something a little bit more conspiratorial, and then you'd end up on, you know, someone like Stefan Molyneux or Alex Jones, both of which people have been banned from YouTube now. So that's an example of how they've done a bit. But I think there's potentially still more that could be done in that space, and particularly in some of the newer social media spaces that I'm a bit less familiar with, but that younger people are using, like TikTok and on Discord and in these spaces. I think that's somewhere to look at as well. I also think it's important to acknowledge that having technical fixes isn't going to be the only solution, because one thing that we have seen since Facebook and YouTube and Twitter as well, and Twitter famously banned, I think, 70,000 accounts after the insurrection in the US last year. So these mainstream social media sites have made an effort, at least, to stop the flow of some of this hate and misinformation. But a lot of people have migrated to what's sometimes called alt-tech, like alternative platforms like Telegram and Gab, Donald Trump's new social media platform, Truth Social. So now that these ideas are very much out there and have a not insignificant number of adherents, they're going to continue to look for ways to spread their ideas online. So while there's more that some of the big social media companies could be doing, we need to be aware not to see it as a panacea for this issue.
We've seen overseas a lot of mainstream, especially conservative politicians, sort of push this narrative, like Tucker Carlson on Fox News, Marine Le Pen spoke a lot about immigration's sort of effect on climate change. And in the US, we've seen sort of the more right-wing arm of the Republicans, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, push these narratives. Should we could be concerned about, what is essentially fascist ideology streaming into mainstream politics?
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I think, a point I've tried to make with some of my activism and my writing. It's more about the ideas than the individuals. So we have in this country some far-right groups that are very small, and they're highly unlikely that a far-right group will get the numbers to, you know, cross the MMP 5% threshold and get into Parliament. But what we do sometimes see happening is these smaller parties that are polling at like 1 or 1.5%, if they start pushing a particular idea and then the larger parties think, hey, they're polling at 1%, we could increase our vote if we maybe adopt some of their policies, then those far-right ideas can sort of move into the mainstream. And an example of that would be the campaign against the UN Migration Compact, which started in Europe with the group Generation Identity and spread around Europe and had an influence there on some of the far-right parties that did have seats in parliaments in Europe. But when it reached New Zealand, the first groups to adopt this idea of like the New Conservative Party, and their outside parliament polls very low, but at these rallies and things they were having, they started to get a bit of momentum, and then ACT started sending representatives to the rallies, and ACT adopted this policy, and then after that the National Party adopted the policy as well. And there was a brief scandal after the Christchurch shooting when it emerged that National had taken a petition off their website against the UN Migration Compact after it became known that the shooter had written on one of his guns, "Here's your Migration Compact," because he was motivated by this campaign as well. And I think while mainstream parties are going to be a little bit more careful now after the Christchurch shooting to try and, you know, win a few extra votes by adopting a, you know, a conspiracy or a misinformation campaign originating on the far right, I certainly don't think it's something we'll never see again. And I think with the eco-fascism and eco-fascist ideas specifically, we're at a time now where we're probably going to look back in a few years and see this sort of time period as the beginning of something that is going to be more significant. Because one of the things we're going to see with climate change, a lot of parts of the world which are quite densely populated are going to, for one reason or another, become much less livable. So we've already seen, like in Pakistan, these heat waves where they're getting over 40 degrees, and you know, people are dying from heat stroke. And some low-lying countries are going to start to see flooding and you know, the failure of crops and things. And what that's going to cause is a lot of people are going to start moving around the world. And when they do that, they're going to move within countries, but they're also going to cross borders. So we're going to see a lot more international migration. We're going to see a lot more refugees, and it's going to be driven by climate change. And I think that when we start to see that, it'll be, you know, like the refugee crisis of 2015, which you know, was the impetus for a lot of political parties and politicians in Europe to fearmonger about immigration and grow their audience and their support base with this issue. We're probably going to see that on a much bigger scale. And when that starts happening, when we're seeing the effects of climate change in a much more significant way than we're seeing now, although we're already starting to see it, but it's going to get worse, I think when that happens, we're going to see a lot more eco-fascist talking points making their way into the mainstream, particularly if we have, you know, politicians like the ones you've mentioned, you know, holding office in the US or in Europe, or, you know, potentially we could end up with some politicians here who, not necessarily coming from a far-right organisation, but who have been influenced by that and start pushing some of those talking points.
That was Byron Clark speaking to Jack about the rise of eco-fascism in the far right.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the show for another week. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, and of course thank you very much to Jack for producing from home. Hope you all enjoyed the show today. A lot of heavy stuff to kind of sit on as we go into the 1-4 with Jin, but thank you very much for tuning in. Before Jin pops into the studio, we've got a bit of Amugi. This is Memories.
All the hype is, squeeze me super narrow just to focus. Sip the bone marrow of your hostess, swallow her sorrow with no feelings. Tryna make myself a little better, tryna get my mouth a little wetter. Caught the scent of some money, finally. Savory but not sweet, it's dirty. Who set the price? Who set the price when it turns out right? I don't wanna be no more, disintegrate and spread my spores. I don't live inside your nostalgia, not care, ape but love on my speed dial. Blank out on molding cartoon reruns, all day wishing I could leave. Should've focused on myself more eternally. I don't really care what your mama says, cause at the end of the day, I ain't gonna pay you to count up the ways that I'm gonna change.
Count up!
I'm gonna do what nobody says.
What my body says.
I don't really care what your mama says, cause at the end of the day, I ain't gonna pay you to count up the ways that I'm gonna change. I'm gonna do what nobody says.
My body
says. I just wanna know how the fuck you focus. Make some hopeless reason your motive. Be a little bit less accountable when you're reeling at your lowest. Gotta make your life a little better. Level up but keep looking backwards. We stay afloat on top of stormy weather. When time's peeling back like forever. Who rolls the dice? Who rolls the dice when you don't think twice? I don't wanna hear that shit again. Not my mind and I don't feel pain. I don't live inside your world only. Home screen blinking, you think you know me. No sleep in the moments are lonely. People trying to make a win. Stressed all the time, won't scrape the 10. I don't really care what your mama says, cause at the end.
with my appearance, with my attitude, and it doesn't matter.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.